the great Robert Zimmerman, no relation.
But don't think twice, it's all right.
Don't vote twice. That concludes this wonderful edition of Earth Watch. Be back next week.
Ain't no use in the turning on your light, babe. The light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Don't vote twice. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Froin coming up at the bottom of the hour. Send me an email, rknight@wbai.org.
Using calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I am told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right. So long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, babe, so I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weeknight program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, E.C. Myers or Eugene Myers, depending on your familiarity, and Eddie Schneider. Stay tuned. Okay, let's see. Announcements. What announcements do I have? There really aren't any, except for next week's New York Review of Science Fiction reading, and this morning's program ties into that so well. I don't need to beat everybody over the head with it, other than to say that this morning's guest, and my guest in 3 weeks? 2 weeks. April 11th, Elia Dawn Johnson, E.C. Myers, Eugene Myers, and Elia Dawn Johnson will be reading this coming Tuesday, April 3rd, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is 138 Sullivan Street, which is between Houston and the street formerly known as Prince. And we start at 6:30. Actually, we start at 7, but I invite people to show up starting at 6:30 so that you can enjoy the artwork. Eugene and Eddie will tell us a little bit more about the artwork involved in Fair Coin, which is a novel just out from... I've never gotten it straight. Pier or Pyre?
Pyre.
Pyre Books. Pyre Books. And by the way, it is a total coincidence that I have had all these people on from Pyre Books. When I talked to Eugene about this, I didn't even know he was being published about Pyre. It sort of began in October when I did this big hullabaloo with the Griffiths family, which is Clay and Susan Griffiths were at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And I had to have them because if you take the first book in their series, Vampire Empire, and you look at the back and you look at the blurbs. Sure. On that, on the first, what's the name of the first book in the Vampire Empire?
It's The Greyfriar.
The Greyfriar, that's it. The Greyfriar. It has this long quote about vampire fiction and all that, and beneath it says, Margot Adler, creator and original host of Hour of the Wolf. And I have always wanted to be a blurber. Not to be blurbed, but to be a blurber. And Margot got there, and she actually used the Hour of the Wolf name. And by complete utter coincidence, since then, a lot of the things that I have done, and it just has to do also John Sprunk, one of Eddie's clients, was on the show. And that was actually before Vampire Empire, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a while back.
Yeah. Let's try and sing that again. Say that again, what you just said.
Yeah, it was a while back.
Okay, now your mic wasn't on, you see.
Ah.
It's this magical thing. It's called Jim trying to engineer. And Eugene, say a couple of words for
me.
Can
you hear me now?
It's not a Sprint show. Try that again.
How about now?
Not really. Yeah. I would like you to pull that mic over to you.
All right.
Ah, yes.
Better?
Yes, much
Great.
Better.
I like this one more anyway.
Okay, yeah, it's got a cool color and all that. And one of these is taped down, and I suspect that's one of the reasons why. So this is just coincidental. There was a point when, you know, it seemed like everybody on the air were coming from Tor books, but that was because Tor is just putting out that many books a year. And there was a certain point where that was it. But for right now, it seems to be Pyre, which is also curious because it's one of the few publishers that isn't in Manhattan. It's not in New York City. It's up in New York State.
Yep.
Practically the border, isn't it?
It's like up near Albany, right? Binghamton?
Yeah, and the editorial.
Is it near Binghamton?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm heading to Binghamton in a couple of months, so it's like, ooh, okay.
And actually, the editorial director is based out of Birmingham, Alabama.
Right. Yeah, Lou
Anders.
Lou Anders. Yeah, who's been doing a very, very good job. Mm-hmm. But the publicists I've been working with are all...
Yeah, they're all up in Amherst.
John Glenn Drive.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, a name that I just can't get over. So Eugene has been on this program. Actually, this is his first novel. Faircoin is his first book. And this is probably your 10th time on the show. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, between actual appearances and dialing in.
Yeah.
It's a little weird to be here to see all these empty seats because usually my writing group is here with us.
Yes, your writing group being?
Altered Fluid.
In fact, take point for a minute, the two of you, and just chat while I go.
Okay.
There's a little bit more. There's an Occupy WBAI meeting. Well, it's actually an Occupy Wall Street meeting going on right outside of this room. And the sound is leaking in. So
I did
the crazy thing of closing the door to the control room just for sound purpose. Well, unsound purposes, but... Altered Fluid is a writer's group. It seems like the next three shows are probably destined, right? Again, total coincidence. I have in the can a recording that I will probably play next week of an interview and reading with Tom Crosshill.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and the and I'm not saying absolutely Tom, who, by the way, lives in Latvia. So when I see a hit of, you know, somebody's listening, I have a listener in Bulgaria. And I have a listener in Latvia, and I know who both of them are. And the, but it's nice to be international. The only reason, there are other people that are just traveling through New York, and live guests bump recorded guests.
Mm-hmm.
Failing that, Tom Cross will be on the program next week, and the week after that, Alaydon Johnson, because her fourth novel. Yes?
Yes.
Let's see. Yes. Fourth novel, not counting graphic novels, yeah.
No, I wasn't counting graphic novels.
All right, so choose your own adventure style books.
Yeah, and this is the second in her 1920s vampire series.
Yeah, yes. Zephyr Hollis.
Yeah, so... for those people who know, I play two kinds of music on this show for the most part. I play Celtic music and I play 20s. So
that will feature heavily in two weeks.
Yeah, exactly. So that'll be here for sure in 2 weeks. That'll be a live program. And after that, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of recorded material. And during I'm going to be attending the Nebula Awards this year. And I have so far 22 1-hour interviews set up for, at the Nebulas. So we're going to see how that's, I'll be there.
Hopefully not consecutive.
Yeah. Better bring some throat drops.
Yeah. actually, most of them are consecutive.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, I'll be there 4 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
22 hours of interviews. Right now, what I'm doing is I'm saying, oh, this person's in New York. Screw it. This person's in Philly. Forget it. I'll do a day in Philadelphia. And so I, you know, you know, Lawrence Shone. No, I'll go visit you. Go away. Go away. You know, and those people. But I've got at least one person from France and all that. And I think I'm going to use that to start off finally, the Hour of the Wolf podcast.
Oh, excellent. Very cool.
Yeah, cool. So, who wants to tell the story of Faircoin? And by that, I mean the book. Okay, no. Let's start with what the story of the story is. What is the premise of the novel? And who is the intended audience?
Okay, well, this is a young adult novel, so the intended audience is about... 14 to 17? Well, 12 to 17, really, but...
It's what we'd probably call within, inside the industry, 12 and up YA. So, yeah. What that really means these days is, 12 to 99.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put an upper limit on it, because the fact of the matter is I love reading YA. There are times... Especially if I'm reading to go to bed, if mm-hmm. I'm reading because I want the fantasy to pass through my mind and something that will provoke thought, but not necessarily bad images. A YA novel is often perfect.
Right. Yeah, and I tend to read a lot of YA as well. But the story of Faircoin, or the basic premise of it, is Ephraim Scott. He's a 16-year-old boy who finds a magic coin, and when he flips the coin and makes a wish, his wish comes true if it lands on heads. And if it lands on tails, there are other consequences, and of course, the story is really about him finding out what's going on with the coin and dealing with the consequences of the wishes that he makes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there seems to be... a lot of coin flipping fantasy, if you will. There's a history of coin flipping science.
There's a long tradition of that. And that was actually one of the things that I was hoping to engage with in the book, and also one of the things that I think has made it possibly a harder sell, at least initially, because there is such a long tradition. You know, people want you to bring something new to the table. And, you know, hopefully I think we've done that.
Yeah, I think so, too. Let's see, there was a terrible movie that I loved as a kid called Zots.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that.
Oh my God. Zots. Yes, Zots, Z-O-T-Z, starring Tom Poston. You flip a coin and reality comes to bear. And it's really a terrible, terrible movie. But, you know, it didn't matter. I was 9 or something like that. There's, of course, a Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, that I think gets referenced in the book.
Well, that's a different story. That's
it's not coin flipping.
Penny for Your Thoughts is the title, and that one is about this guy flips a coin into a case and it lands on its edge, which is pretty unlikely. And as long as that coin remains on its edge, he is able to hear the thoughts of other people.
Right,
and that's completely fascinating.
Who wrote that?
You know, I don't recall. I want to say Matheson, but I don't think
it's a Matheson-like story. Yeah. Very much.
Yeah,
so.
But it stars is it Dick Sargent or Dick York or
it's
one of the Darrens. It's one of the Darrens from Bewitched.
Yeah, it's a Darren. I don't quite recall. Eddie, Eugene said it was a hard sell. Was it?
It took a while. It was an easy sell in the end, but as often the case with first novels, it collected 15 or 20 rejection letters before someone finally realized they should be publishing it and proceeded to.
But that's often the case, isn't it? Especially with first novels.
Yeah, I mean, J.K. Rowling had 40 plus rejections. If you look at pretty much anyone, occasionally there'll be an outlier who will get published easily, but most of the time, there's a big stack of rejection letters that comes before a first novel sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as they say, you know, all you need is one yes, and a lot of the time, I think. It's a matter of finding the right person for the book. So somebody who believes in it and loves it as much as the author does and is going to support it as much as they can. And that held true through my agent querying process and the submission process and all that. And even though it took a while, I don't think it could have turned out any better than it did.
Now, you two did not know each other before this?
No.
No. This was...
Because I actually had it the wrong way around, because I know Eddie through other people in the same writer's group initially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I had not realized that the working relationship of you two came first.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, you know,
yeah, I mean, I went through the
this
whole.
This is an interviewer's dream. Yeah. I'm now on this whole thing. And I get. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I went through.
I've got a cold. It's, you guys have to do the work here.
I went through the standard, you know, agent querying process, which, you know, I researched young adult agents who represent young adult science fiction and fantasy. And I wrote a query letter and a synopsis and I submitted it. And, you know, that was probably about a 7-month long process for me. And I queried, originally I queried Jabberwocky, I queried Joshua Bilmes, who...
Jabberwocky being a literary agency.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, they had been closed to submissions for a while for the pretty much most of the time that I was actually querying. And then Eddie joined up and he represents the young adult side of things at Jabberwocky primarily, and Jess is doing that now as well.
Yeah, we now have a third agent, and possibly we'll have a fourth within the next few months.
Cool.
Anyway, so yes, the query process it worked in sort of the classic manner, and goes to show that yes, that actually does work.
Yeah, it just takes, you know, it takes persistence. I think it takes a good query letter. And a good synopsis. Obviously, it takes a good book, I think. But the query letter I worked on just as much as any other piece of writing. I think I probably revised that thing for about a month. I ran it through my writing group, Altered Fluid. They reviewed and critiqued the query letter and the synopsis. It's a writing skill just like any other.
And it's a part of the process that needs to be taken, you know, as seriously as any other part. You want to try to attract the right kind of attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, the answer to the all important question is A, Dick York.
Okay.
Okay.
And B, George Clayton Johnston.
Ah.
Who also
yes.
wrote Logan's Run, co-wrote.
Yeah.
Logan's
and he wrote
Run
like
William
what
F.
six
Nolan.
Or seven other episodes, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was very active in the era, but I had to look that up.
Well, thank you.
That's important stuff. So, do you want to go straight from that to a reading, or where would you like to carry this?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm happy to keep talking about the book, or I could do the reading and then see where the discussion goes after that. What?
Well,
you know.
First caller decides.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
Okay, something just whizzed over my head. When I say I have a cold, I am not kidding.
No, first call.
The first caller decides what happens next.
Oh, the first caller decides.
Yeah. And feeling that, you flip a coin.
Okay, fine. Fair coin. Okay, 212-209-2900. First caller decides reading or talking, okay? And democracy now, I don't... Don't buy that for a second. but that's assuming that the phone system is working, curiously.
Maybe also true.
You see what we should have done? Of course, I know.
Yes.
Let's flip a coin.
That's not a real coin, Jim. It's chocolate.
Let's flip the chocolate. I know, but as a diabetic, I'm as likely to eat this as I am anything else. Okay, heads reading, tails talking, chocolating. Okay, so, and I'm going to spin it rather than flip it.
Okay, so he's spinning the coin.
Oh, now a call's coming.
Oh, now we've got a call.
Okay, well, it's tails.
Hmm.
Okay, let's see here. Hi there, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, reading.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll get with the caller.
All right. Okay, that overrules the tales.
Yeah, because tales, nothing. It doesn't necessarily come true.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to read two short selections from early chapters of the book. At this point, the setup is that Ephraim comes home from school one day, and he finds his mother unconscious at the kitchen table. She has overdosed on some sleeping pills. She, earlier in the day, identified a body that she believed to be Ephraim's, and obviously it isn't Ephraim. And he fortunately gets home in time to save her. And at the hospital, he learns about his supposed doppelganger, and he finds some interesting items that were in the other boy's pockets, including a strange coin. So he spends the night at the hospital, and now he is at school the next morning, having not gotten very much sleep. And it's the last day of school, so he's cleaning out his locker. When he opened his locker, a piece of paper fluttered out. He bent to retrieve it from the floor. "Make a wish and flip the coin to make it come true," he read. It looked like Nathan's handwriting. What the hell is that supposed to mean? He tossed it to his friend. Nathan read it. "Weird. I don't know." "That isn't your handwriting?" Ephraim was sure of it. "I did not leave a note in your locker. That's so elementary school." Nathan scrunched up his eyes as he looked at it again. "It does look like my handwriting. A little. But I don't know what it's supposed to mean. What coin? It doesn't make any sense." He handed the note back to Ephraim. Ephraim stared at it. Could it be referring to the quarter he'd found last night? He hadn't even mentioned that to Nathan yet. This was as unsettling as the duplicate library card and the idea of another kid who looked like him. But what did it mean, and who had written the note? He pulled the quarter from his back pocket and reread the note one more time. "You're actually going to try it?" Nathan snorted. Ephraim shrugged. "No harm in it." He held the coin flat on his palm and cleared his throat. "I wish..." He glanced at Nathan. "I wish my mom wasn't in the hospital." Nothing happened, of course. "Flip it," Nathan said, like the note said. "Never mind, this is silly." Ephraim moved to put it back in his pocket and felt a jolt in his palm, as if someone had stabbed it with a pin. He dropped the coin and it rolled away on the uneven gray tiles. "Ow," he muttered. "What happened?" "It shocked me," Ephraim said, glancing around. The coin had landed under the locker across from him. He crouched and picked it up, shaking off clumps of dust. It had come up heads. The metal felt hot for a second, but it quickly cooled in his hand. His vision swam, and he suddenly felt nauseous. He clutched his stomach. "Ephraim," Nathan said, "what are you doing on the floor?" He had to get to the bathroom. He wasn't going to make it. Ephraim turned and stuck his head into his locker. "Dude," Nathan said. He moved to the other side of the hall while Ephraim vomited. Ephraim wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "Sorry," he said. He held his breath and closed the door of his locker, deciding he didn't really need the papers and comic books that had accumulated at the bottom throughout the year. He walked to the water fountain at the end of the hall to rinse out his mouth. The water was warm and tasted metallic. "Are you all right? The nurse might still be here," Nathan said. "I feel fine now." It was as though nothing had happened. Ephraim stuffed the quarter and the note in his pocket and grabbed his backpack. He suddenly realized how lucky he was. If that had happened while he'd been talking to Jenna... "But you just barfed in your locker. I mean, at least tell the janitor." Nathan turned his camera so Ephraim could see the screen. It was a blurry shot of Ephraim with his head tucked into his locker. It was enough to make him feel queasy again. He pushed the camera away. "I'm so glad I have you around to document my greatest moments," Ephraim said. "The camera doesn't lie," Nathan said. "You really are that much of a tool. You sure you're okay?" "Maybe I caught a bug at the hospital," Ephraim said. He'd been sitting there all night, after all. But who'd ever heard of a 24-second stomach flu? "When were you in the hospital?" Nathan asked. "I just told you. My mom went in last night." "Oh, no." Nathan's eyes widened. "Is it serious? How's Madeline?" "Did we not just have this conversation?" Nathan must have been more distracted by the twins than he'd thought. "She'll recover. I'm catching a ride with Mary and Shelley to the hospital now," Ephraim said slowly. "Remember?" Nathan seemed even more surprised by that. "You're kidding. I'd love to share a back seat with them. Man, I wish my mom were in the hospital." "Careful what you wish for," Ephraim said. "Wait a minute. Wish?" He just made a wish that his mother wasn't in the hospital. Now Nathan didn't remember it. "Hey, you should try to sit between them," Nathan said. "Still not a good idea," Ephraim said. Down the hallway, Michael Gopal came around the corner and grinned when he caught sight of them. "Crap," Ephraim said. Nathan looked at Michael calmly as he stomped toward them. What? He's not going to try anything. It's the last day of school. That's like a truce. It's more like there's no one here to stop him, Ephraim said. It was Michael's end-of-year ritual, to track down his favorite victims and give them something to remember him by over the summer. Michael stopped in front of them and crossed his arms, legs planted apart. He was as squat and thick as the twins were tall and thin, and almost as well-endowed, with flabby man boobs. Ephraim had heard that he was taking steroids to bulk up for football. "Where do you think you're going, Mackenzie?" Michael said. "We didn't have a chance to say goodbye yet." "Time to go," Ephraim said, taking a step back. Nathan usually followed his lead in situations like this, but he seemed strangely unconcerned. "Are you kidding? He doesn't scare me," Nathan said. "Have a nice summer, Michael." He lifted the camera and the flash went off. This only enraged Michael, like a bull with a flag waved in front of it. "What's with you?" Ephraim asked Nathan. Ephraim grimaced as Michael grabbed Nathan by the straps of his backpack and shoved him hard against the locker. The bag loaded with books took the brunt of the impact, but Nathan's head whipped back and rang against the flimsy metal. A number of locker doors around the school bore Nathan-sized dents. You could almost chart Nathan's growth over the years by them. "Ow," Nathan said. "Sorry, I meant I hope you have a crappy summer." Michael scowled and shook Nathan from left to right. "What's got you so happy, Mackenzie? Glad you won't be seeing me every day?" Nathan's hair had fallen over his forehead. His eyes peeked through his bangs, and he smiled. "Sadly, I won't have the pleasure of summer classes with you. Have fun with that." Ephraim winced. "Don't taunt him, Nathan." All right, so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Nathan gets beat up, and Ephraim leaves him to fend for himself. This happens a little bit later. Ephraim has been using the coin. He's been testing the coin out and brought Nathan in on it with him. When Ephraim got home, Nathan was lying on the floor by his bed, leafing through a stack of the old Playboy magazines Ephraim had rescued from the trash after his father left. "How the hell did you get in here?" Ephraim asked. "Madeline let me in," Nathan said. "These are so awesome." He was looking at an article that promised to teach 32 surefire ways to put a woman in the mood. Presumably, none of those included the aid of a magic coin. Ephraim dropped his bag on the floor and noticed a plate of oatmeal cookies on his desk beside an empty glass of milk. "My mother gave you cookies?" She never let Ephraim snack on junk food before dinner, especially in his room. He popped a cookie in his mouth whole. "She lured me in with them," Nathan said. "I couldn't resist." "Don't make that sound naughty. She's my mother." Ephraim slumped into his desk chair and woke his computer up from hibernation. "Where is she, anyway?" Nathan closed the magazine and put it aside. "She went out, and I have to say, she looked really hot." "She must have another date tonight." "You didn't take a picture, did you?" Ephraim asked. "What do you take me for?" "Hand over your camera." "There's no picture." "Nathan," Ephraim said. "How was work?" "Have fun with Jenna?" Nathan asked. Everything that he had said sounded suggestive. He was being more of a pervert than usual. "Why did you come over if you knew I wasn't home?" Ephraim asked. Nathan's eyes were glued on a platinum blonde who was leaning over with her breasts cradled in her arms. "I wanted to thank you for last night." Nathan wiggled his eyebrows. "Okay, you have to cut that out." Nathan tossed the magazine on the floor and picked up another one. "Mary really likes you," he said. "Why'd you have to ignore her like that?" "I just couldn't think about anything but Jenna leaving," Ephraim said. "Why do you suddenly like her more than Mary?" "I just do. Why do you like Shelley?" Nathan grinned. "Okay, besides her obvious assets," Ephraim said. "What's wrong with liking someone because they're attractive?" Nathan flipped over onto his back and held an open magazine over his face. "Because there's more to them than that. Why do you like Shelley instead of her sister? They look the same." "Because she likes me." Nathan lifted the magazine and looked at Ephraim. "Thanks to you. I guess you probably wouldn't be as interested in me without your coin." Ephraim smirked. "So you believe me now?" "I think I might need more proof." "What's our next coin trick?" "What?" "Well, this was just the start. We can have anything we want," Nathan said. "I still feel bad enough about what we did to Shelley." "What we did to her?" Nathan sat up and dropped the magazine into his lap. "Hey, be careful with those." Ephraim went over and began stacking the magazines neatly. "You don't think she could like me without the coin?" Nathan asked. "I didn't say that. But we made her like you, so we'll never know, will we?" Anger flickered over Nathan's face. "You did the same thing to Jenna." "That was different," Ephraim said. "Of course it was." Nathan jumped up from the bed, then flopped onto the desk chair. Ephraim left the magazines on the floor and sat on the edge of the bed facing him. It was an accident when I did it, Ephraim said. But you didn't feel bad about it when you realized what had happened, did you? Do you? Ephraim drew in a breath. No. See? I don't think we should use it to manipulate people anymore. It doesn't feel right. Nathan laughed, a harsh sound that Ephraim wasn't expecting. What? Ephraim asked. Because it's me who's getting the girl, Nathan said. No, that's not... I thought we were going to share the coin, Nathan said. I never agreed... If I had found it first, I would share it with you. Nathan crossed his arms. I am sharing, Ephraim said. Look, what do you think this coin is for? What do you think we should wish for? World peace? Something like that. Ephraim frowned. He'd been too preoccupied helping himself to consider that he could use it for some greater good. Maybe Nathan was right, and he shouldn't keep this to himself. But we don't really know how the coin works. I think we should take it slow and try to figure out what its limits are. It hasn't always done exactly what I expected. If we wish for world peace, we could just as easily wipe out everyone as get them to stop fighting. It's like the coin makes arbitrary trade-offs when it gives us what we want. Like how Nathan's wish had led to Jenna's impending departure from Summerside. Nathan nodded. Okay, we'll take it slow for a while. Stick to small wishes. And we won't use it to change people's feelings or force them to do anything they wouldn't want to do, Ephraim said. Nathan snorted. Whatever. People manipulate each other every day without the benefit of a magic coin. But if you want to play it safe... Ephraim took out the coin. We also have to make sure we're touching when I make the wish. Now who's being pervy? Nathan asked. So what's it going to be this time, boss? I'm going to wish that Jenna doesn't have to leave. Nathan coughed a word. Hypocrite. This doesn't count as manipulating her feelings, Ephraim said. It's true that I don't want to lose her, not now that things are starting to work out. But she doesn't want to move either. Nathan yawned. Well, let's do it. Ephraim grabbed Nathan's left hand with his and made his wish. I wish that Jenna didn't have to move away, he said. Ephraim told himself that he was doing this for Jenna, not just for himself. He flipped the coin in his right hand and caught it. Tails, he said. Ephraim felt a sideways lurch, like he was on a train that had braked abruptly. The air around him rippled, and a moment later he wasn't in his room anymore. He was sitting in a booth at a diner, and Mary was across from him holding his hand, instead of Nathan. Ephraim said. And I will leave it there.
From the novel Fair Coin, read for you by the author, E.C. Myers. This is Moonshi, over WBAI in New York. And we are back. I should just tell you listeners a little bit something about that. There's a new Steel I Span album out, okay? And for those who don't know about me and Steel I Span, well, trust me. I love Steel I Span, and if I had more than a 90-minute show, you'd be hearing a great deal of Steel I Span on this show. And you do during the outro anyway, Sales of Silver. But there being a new double album, Now We Are Six Again, which is basically a live version of their classic album, Now We Are Six, which was a pun because it was their sixth album, and they had added percussion to the band, so it was the sixth member and all that. They've recorded that album, but live, with a new layout of the band, which are, well, six people. And I thought, what the heck? You know, I mean, I can buy this at Amazon, or I can call up and say, hi, I'm one of the people that actually plays Steel I Span a lot on my radio show. It just meant calling England. And I did that, and somebody from Park Records, which is Steel I Span's label, called back, amazingly, because there's, you know, what, 8-hour difference.
Right, yeah. Five to London.
Five. Yeah. There was enough of a difference. But nevertheless, they called me back, and they sent me the new Steel I album. But they also, unrequested, unbidden, sent me this album called Moon... pardon me. Moonshi. M-O-O-N... apostrophe S-H-E-E. It's basically this Celtic band with tabla and sitar. And but what you just heard, of course, is a Beatles song.
Yeah.
But it's not actually representative. I mean, the rest of the tunes are either original or Celtic tunes, but done with that sound. And I have to say, I love their sound. It's really unique. Park Records scored by wisely sending me this, and now I can tell them that, yes, I asked for one album for airplay, but I played a different one instead, because, well, there it is. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Eddie Schneider and Eugene Myers, agent and writer. Both. And that was fun.
Thanks.
That was nice. And you see, I think you have to drop the 4-9, you know, from the 14 till 19. You can't put an upper limit. I mean, I enjoyed reading it, you know, so am I like out of...
No, I mean, there's an age range for a target audience, but obviously you always hope that more people will read it.
Let me put a question to the both of you. YA, this is a marketing term. Yes. Science fiction is a marketing term.
Yes.
It is. I mean, if it wasn't for publishers trying to pigeonhole, these words wouldn't exist. We use the wrong names for all of this. You like science fiction? You really ought to read Tolkien. You know, it's true.
Right.
It seems to me that so much of what I've read and loved through the years is what today would be called young adult. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, today Frederick Brown and Richard Matheson and Robert Sheckley and a lot of the great short story writers of the 50s. There weren't that many women then, and if there were, then they were C.L. Moore, right, or names like that. I'm wondering if today they wouldn't be called YA.
There's a lot that was written before, you know, the last decade or so that would probably be YA today. One example, really obvious example, is Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game, which has been repackaged and is now being sold as YA.
Yeah, and still appearing in the adult section with a different cover, you know. And sometimes do they call that a crossover book?
Yeah.
And that's truly annoying. It is, because why is it a crossover? Well, okay, maybe it is crossing over, but the idea that this is something that they've done where Octavia Butler will be sold as black women's literature.
Mm-hmm.
But why isn't that? Why is that then not sold as science fiction?
Right.
Some of that comes down to strange and arcane decisions that the buyers make for the bookstores that agents aren't necessarily very privy to. But
yeah, I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah.
As an agent,
speak for your industry.
It's hard because as a seller. You want to sell as many people as you can.
And as a seller, if you get someone who says, yes, we'll take the book into the store, often that's the end of the conversation. And so if it's the seller talking to the buyer for the African-American fiction section that used to exist at the Borders bookstores, and they're like, well, we'll take it, then, you know, that's that. Even if...
Because I've seen The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin in social studies, in... hey, Lester! The Dispossessed, I've seen it in political science.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it in... Well, it's very...
I mean, it's not out of place in those places.
No, it's not out of place, but the thing is, when you look at the spine of the book...
It says science fiction, and it's...
No, it didn't.
It didn't.
That was actually my point, that it didn't say science fiction.
Interesting.
And I was working in a bookstore at the time, so I actually bought three versions of The Dispossessed, the women's studies version, the science fiction version, and the political science version, and each one on the spine was exclusive of the other two.
Wow. Did they have different cover art as well?
Yes.
Wow.
I think that's actually smart of the different publisher blurbing. Because a lot of this is generalizing, but often you don't necessarily get readers floating from one section to the other as much as maybe that would hope that someone would be doing. And so there it is right there. With packaging to appeal.
Well, and you see that even with I think we did this here, but even so, Harry Potter obviously kicked off a big middle grade and young adult wave, as they say, and the book was so popular, adults were reading it.
Yeah,
and at least in the UK, they had different editions for children and adults.
Did they really?
So they would have
Bloomsbury.
Bloomsbury. So they would have the children's edition, and then the adult version would be a picture of an actual train, a photo of a train on the cover for Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, because thinking that adults wouldn't want to be seen reading, something with a more cartoonish art on it.
Yeah, it just always annoys the heck out of me because Eddie's. I hope everybody watching their radio sees that Eddie raises his eyebrows, going,
"Yeah."
So because
right. watching the
because you represent the selling part of the industry, your Parts goal of, is to get so, the thing into it, yes. the damn
yeah.
store.
Yeah, and also true.
And it's so difficult to get it into the store.
That you'll take whoever's willing to put it there,
whatever often. Means.
Yeah.
When you were writing this, Eugene, did you say to yourself, "This will"? I assume in the case of this book, you said this is a YA novel.
Yes.
Because I have you on the show saying that.
Yes. No. I knew from the start that I wanted it to be a YA book. My wife read the first draft and she said, "This isn't YA, it's middle grade." I was like, "Well,
then I'm gonna..." Please.
I mean, we've gone back and forth on that.
How about
a few
young
times.
At heart?
But no, I intended it to be YA, and Eddie read it as YA, and Lou Anders read it as YA, and the bookstores are mostly categorizing it as YA. So, it is young adult, but the. We were talking about age ranges, and the truth is that They say that, that young readers will read up. So really, you would be getting middle grade readers looking at this now. And when I was a kid and I was, you know, 14 or 15, I was already in the adult science fiction section.
That's right.
I was reading Heinlein, and I don't think I'd discovered
not the Heinlein juveniles, but the hard Heinlein.
Yeah, the actual the older books. And probably
there's a term you don't hear anymore: juveniles.
Juveniles, yeah.
Because that was a time
you still see it as a category.
There's a juvenile fiction and in at least some Barnes & Noble locations for sort of the 10 to 14 age range.
Yeah, but I mean today very clearly we would call Heinlein's the Rolling Stones. Days today it's young adult, but clearly Heinlein called them the Heinlein juveniles. Simon and Schuster was very, or was it Scribner? Scribner's, I think, was very, very specific in branding them the Heinlein juveniles, and actually sold box sets.
Yeah,
and they used that word.
I will say this though, since we're talking about sort of putting things in boxes and coming up with almost arbitrary categories for the sake of marketing within young adult, there are many different genres as we think of them. So there's science fiction and there's fantasy and there's contemporary, there's historical, there's romantic comedies, all those things. But within publishing, the umbrella young adult is it. So you don't see a young adult section broken up most of the time into fantasy or science fiction. They may feature them on particular shelves, but when you go to, they're generally all shelved together. And I think that's really interesting. It's really exciting because
that is exciting.
Because at that age, I read everything. Everything.
You read books.
I read books. I read cereal boxes and everything else. But I read everything, and I read science fiction, I read fantasy, I read Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew. I read whatever my sister brought home. So I was reading Christopher, she was like 4 years older than me. I was reading Christopher Pike and Sweet Valley High and The Babysitter's Club and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and all of these books. And I didn't care because they were books. So I had a pretty broad exposure to different types of fiction.
Sadly, that's changing a little bit with the shelving schemes. So if you were to go to your local Barnes & Noble and look for Fair Coin, you would find it in the young adult fantasy and adventure section, which is new within the last few months. They've sort of...
Wow, so they are starting to break out.
They're starting to break out. There's young adult fiction. There's... young adult paranormal, which is all the paranormal romance. And then there's fantasy and adventure.
Yeah, although God knows some of that.
Fantasy and adventure is pretty broad. But
Yeah. I mean, the YA paranormal romance stuff that gets mailed me is one step away from R-rated.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not one step away. That's what... inside the industry, they'll call 14 and up is that it gets a bit racier.
14 and up. Okay, yeah.
So as opposed to 12 and up because PG-13.
Yeah, but that stuff is something that's pretty hardcore. I must say. So it's an interesting thing. I'm actually hoping that, while the e-books provide a lot of negative aspects to publishing, one of the positive aspects may be that there'll be less
hang-ups and
but also you can just check off of all these different categories. You can say it's for young people, check. It's for adults, check. It's fantasy, check. It's this, check.
And if you're a reader and you happen to be searching for something within a particular genre or subgenre, then you can find it. And that holds true for the same book across, many different genres. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, something new that Barnes & Noble has been doing in the last few months that I noticed is when you buy a book and, you get your receipt, there's another little slip of paper that comes along with it that says you might also be interested in, and then it lists, four or five recommendations of other books that are in that area, and they may not all be the same type. So they might be, if you picked up Fair Coin, the other books might all be young adult books, but they wouldn't all be, you know, science fiction. So it's kind of interesting to see that.
Well, and that's of course something that's been happening online to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That you
but they're actually doing this. I mean, obviously,
but now it's actually happening in brick and mortar.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what sort of algorithms they're using, if they're just kind of pulling, you know, their popular titles or their newest titles or whatever, and it's obviously designed to sell more books in the store. But I think it's a good thing because, you know, how else do you know what to read unless you're recommended. If somebody says, well, if you like this, then you may like this, you know. And then there are a lot of websites like Goodreads and sort of online forums.
I love Goodreads.
And blogs and things where, you know, you can see what other people are reading, and if their tastes run similar to yours, then you'll take their recommendations seriously.
And do you have any favorite sites for that?
Well, like I said, I use Goodreads pretty regularly.
As a reader and first as a reader
and more recently as a writer. Mostly I use it to keep track of what I've been reading, and because I have unfortunately a terrible memory for titles and authors and things. And when somebody will say, well, what have you read recently that's really good? You know, I'll look at my list and say, okay, well, I gave this book 5 stars. So, you know, these are, and it's also there as a resource. So people who want my opinion on books or want to see what I've been reading can go and look to see what has spoken to me. And I get, you know, emails of what my friends are reading and what my friends are recommending. And, you know, and actually as an author, Goodreads has been great in terms of just getting word about Fair Coin out, because, you know, there was a page for this book almost immediately after the sale was announced, and people were starting to add it to their shelves. And
we should mention to listeners that Goodreads is basically a social network for talking about books.
Yes. Yeah,
so it's becoming a great place for writers to show up and say,
yes,
"Hi, this is my book," and having Q&A.
Yes, readers can rate books. They can write mini reviews of books. They can engage directly with the author, which is wonderful. And sometimes, you know, obviously, it's also possibly fraught with danger, but.
Just like,
you know, you can do
calls. Yes.
Yeah, but you can do Q&A, you can do book group discussions. Goodreads will often feature author interviews, and they send out a monthly newsletter that also like highlights, oh, well, you know, you've read these books, here's that author's new book that's coming out, you know, that sort of a thing. So it's a really great community.
And there's for those of you listening, this may be relevant, there's a Goodreads science fiction fantasy book club that has, I think it's north of 5,000 members. And every month they vote on what they're going to read next and have group discussions.
You know, I haven't been a part of that. I should be, because I really I can get very jaded about social networks. And I speak as a person who started on bulletin board systems in the early 80s. And so, you know, very much been there and done that before the internet, not before the internet's existence, but before its use as a social place. And I ran areas on CompuServe and stuff like that. So I've been through this for many, many years. And I really could care less when I see that blah, blah, blah has just challenged me in a game such and such. And by the way, I want everybody listening to join the Hour of the Wolf group on. I finally started a Facebook Hour of the Wolf group, although the one I'm more involved with is the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group, which I've actually been pushing and already have like 150 members or something like that. Not bad for a reading series with a capacity of 60 or 70 people.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of what you think of the social networks, I think that, you know, people do use them, and it's important to have a place there.
Yeah, but you see, that's also for publicity. From my point of view, it's that I get to go on there and say, hey, guess who's on my show tonight, and make sure that it's on both of your pages as well. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, I've already got the web.
Right.
Why do I need a social network, which is basically, no, don't go to the web, go to me. Mm-hmm. And go to my social network instead of their social network.
And a lot of those, are, you know, in existence to make a lot of A, ad revenue, and B, to sort of monetize the users in other ways. Right now, anyway, Goodreads is one that isn't particularly clogged with advertising, and there's a pretty good signal to noise ratio as far as comments and so forth go for books.
Yeah. Although I will go to Goodreads.com, and I have not joined the Goodreads group on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And there is one, and that's so, you know, I don't care what portal people use to get onto Goodreads, I rather use the web. But this is a case in which a social network is exactly that. It's a book group. Mm-hmm. It's an actual thing where if I wasn't using a computer, I would attend. I would be happy to go to a place where people were – I'm really not interested in going to the kind of place that, you know, that everybody on Facebook is, you know, crowding around.
Right.
Oh, yes, I really like, you know, this particular candy bar. But Goodreads is, you know.
Yeah, Goodreads is great, and there are and I knew that there were a lot of book blogs, like young adult book blogs out there. But since I've been seeing things from the author side, there are far more than even I knew of. And a big portal for this sort of thing is YA Book Central. They really seem to be like the go-to website if you're trying to find out, you know, what's coming out and what people are excited about, and you can post reviews there as well. They have a really strong community component there, so it's almost like its own small social media, but it's been customized to, you know, a very well, it's a big group, but it's a specific group of readers, and yeah, there are a lot of book blogs out there.
Now, of course, there's another kind of community, and that's the listening community. And if you would like to call up and speak with Eddie Schneider or Eugene Myers about their work, agent and author, the telephone number here at Hour of the Wolf over WBAI is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. Seems to be one of the few times I can get to actually give out the phone number and not ask for money at the nice. Same time. Eddie, who are some of the other people within genre that you're repping?
Within genre that I'm repping, John Sprunk, who's been on the air, Mark Hodder, who is also published by Pyre Books, Adam Troy Castro.
I want him on my show. I didn't know you represented him.
It looks like we have a caller. He's going to be coming after
like 2 or 3.
After WorldCon, the week after WorldCon, he's going to be on the East Coast. So
excellent.
Maybe we should.
He used to live in New York, though.
He did, yes.
And like, I never had him on. I've met him like once. I really enjoy his writing.
He has a new middle grade book coming out.
Yep, a new middle grade series that he's going to be doing some visits for.
Uh-huh. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were up to Adam Troy Castro. Are there others?
Deanie Lowe, who had written a young adult paranormal mystery that was nominated for an Edgar Award. Jancy Patterson, who's another debut author whose book is going to be coming out this fall, finally.
Chasing the Skip.
Yes. Yeah. And a couple of people who I can't announce yet.
Okay, cool. That
I don't even know about
that. There's mystery involved. 212-209-2900. You guys are going to need headphones in order to hear the callers. And we have at least one, so let's give it a try. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Yeah, turn on your radio. The delay gets confusing.
I say it's a good book, but it reminds me of two other books that I think I read when I was in my youth. The Monkey Paw, and like how you say, Aladdin Lamp, you know, where the trade off. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Get back to the point, like in the Monkey Paw, I think the mother's son was dead and she had one of them back, but it was like you say, the trade off. If you didn't, how you say,
Yeah, there are consequences to your wishes.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, right. W.W. Jacobs, if anybody's looking up the monkey paw. I love that story.
You're very interesting, my man. That's all I had to say. And you're right. Hey, keep it up, man.
Thank you.
Oh, and another thing. That story about the corn, that sounds like, what was the Rod Serling Twilight Zone?
Yes, yes.
Yep. Ah, good. The old Grace Zelda on corn after all.
Okay.
Good show, man.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling.
Have a great morning. 212-209-2900. Yeah, the monkey's paw, and what was the other that he mentioned?
Oh, Aladdin's lamp.
Yep. Yeah, Aladdin's lamp, which is, of course, and that gets into the whole Arabian Nights thing, where you never know. The question is, whose version of the Arabian Nights are you reading?
Right.
How much has it been, the whole Arabian Nights is so fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, say what you will about Disney. I mean, Aladdin is one of my favorite Disney pictures. So I won't hear any bad words about it.
Yeah, well, you're of that age. This is something that I get into, and then I decided some time back about a member of your writers group, a Mr. Kressel, I think his name is, where he and I love to get on each other's case about, you know, the quality of Blade Runner.
Blade Runner, yeah. Don't get him started on that. Yeah,
oh boy.
Well, I got him. When I moved to this time slot, one of the very first episodes we had was the director and writer Edward Einhorn of the off Broadway production of Drew Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, and Matt Kressel. Mm-hmm. And me, who's sort of like bordering, because I thought the play was brilliant. I think the movie has amazing qualities, but I don't see it as great. And then I started thinking about, why don't I see that as great? Why do I see 2001: A Space Odyssey great? And why does Matt see Blade Runner as great? And why do certain people see this film as great and that film? And I came up with a theory. Our age when we saw those films. I was 13 when I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey, or 14 or 15.
I think, at least in the case of Blade Runner, I mean, I saw it at a pretty young age as well. However, the first version that I saw was the theatrical edition.
With
the narration, you know, and, you know, obviously not the director's vision.
Yeah.
Of the film, and that, you know, I think it is a good movie.
I think it's a good movie. I think it has issues.
Yes, yes. But Matt loves it, and he actually skipped a writing group meeting to go see the director's cut in theaters again, which I will never let him forget. And I have yet to witness this, but every New Year's he recites the film from memory.
Yeah.
So.
No, I can appreciate that, because I have that relationship with other things.
Yeah.
And also my main reason for dissing Blade Runner is, if I'm in this room alone and on the air and not feeling like I have anything vital to say, and I just want to get the phones lit up. Two words will do it. Blade Runner sucks. 212-209-2900. And I've got a show for the next 2 hours. Yeah. Wow. You know, that's it. I don't even believe it or buy. But then again, I don't think so many talk show hosts believe half of what they say anyway. Mm. And when it comes to that, I don't think it sucks. I think it's a very, very good movie. I just think it could have been the best. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that it was. And that's where Matt and I think part company. But the very interesting thing is that when he was finally on the spot with this playwright who loves the movie and who loves the written Philip K. Dick, I think we each represented, there was the play, there was the movie, and there was me for the written word, and an advocate for each. We were all far more conciliatory to the other points of view than any would imagine. And to bring this back around to Fair Coin, I think that this is very relevant because of the target age of the reader for this book by, and we should say it, E.C. Myers, published by Pyer Books. Mm-hmm. You said it was Pyer, right?
Pyer, yes.
Yeah, but there's no E on the end. It's P-Y-R.
They are aware that they are pronouncing it in an unorthodox manner.
Yeah.
But it was a calculated decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, because why do so many book companies, this is a whole other thing.
Oh boy.
I mean, why do they involve fire? Why do they involve burning
things? Well, in this case.
I mean, Kindle? Really?
Well, in this case, Pyer is an imprint of Prometheus Books, so you can see the obvious connection there.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, the guy who brings fire
but
to
then
people.
There's
burning books. It just doesn't work for me.
There's the Firebird imprint at Penguin.
Right.
Uh-huh, that's right. Sharon November runs that, yes.
And I'm sure that there are many others that have completely exited my brain. So
yeah, I mean, and what's the name of the new Kindle?
The Kindle Fire.
So you're going to read on your Kindle Fire.
Pyre should totally get on that and just have some kind of, you know.
The Pyre Phoenix. Or,
yeah.
Yeah, it's time to, you know, put these but fires
actually,
out.
There's the Phoenix books.
That's right. Yeah, but that's reborn from ashes, you know, but yeah, fire has to come first. I just don't know why the fire, of all the elements, books should be airy, or they should be, you know, I guess you don't want them to be waterlogged, but it's just, I don't know, maybe it's the German background in me. I don't like the idea of book burning.
No.
Yeah, it's a rant, I'm sorry. Somebody else should rant. 212-209-2900. How has reception been?
Critically, it's been pretty good. There have been. I would say that most of the reviews have been good to great, which is nice. But it's hard.
I've seen some great reviews.
Yeah. I mean, well, I'll admit, I saw one intensely negative review, but I won't
dwell on that. It happens.
It happens. I was waiting for it. It's another.
Well,
it's another rite of passage.
Haters.
It's another rite of passage.
If you're not pissing somebody off, you're doing it wrong.
But it was a blogger.
No, it was. I think it was a book reviewer. I'm not going to point it out. I don't want you to find it.
Okay.
I think it's still pretty early to say how it's doing in sales.
It is. It takes a little while to know. With the first novel.
I was going to say, the first book.
And then also when we're looking at children's books, it's not as easy to get data on institutional sales. So later in the process, when we start to get royalty statements, we'll see how many books have sold into various library systems.
Yeah. How about foreign rights?
Foreign rights. I was just in Bologna last week for the International Children's Book Fair there, and came back.
That's pretty much the.
It's
show,
the annual show for children's and young adult books, and boy, were there a lot of requests for fair coin, and in particular from Scandinavia. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, do either of you get any say whatsoever in the translation process?
There's language in the contracts that says that it'll be a faithful and accurate translation, and a lot of translators will contact the author about, you know, with a lot of different questions, and sometimes about localizations of things that wouldn't translate easily.
Hmm. Would you say translations have improved in recent years?
I've only been an agent for 4 years, so I don't have the perspective on that one.
The long view, yeah. I just know that growing up, I read certain Grimm's fairy tales, and for that matter, we mentioned it earlier, Aladdin, mm-hmm. and you know, simply the tales from the Thousand and One Nights, the Scheherazade stories. And what I read was, you know, well, okay, good for Disney,
right.
But if you read the original stuff in proper translations, not necessarily Aladdin, but even there, and some of the other stories, a lot of that stuff is, A, not well worded and could be mm-hmm. translated so much better than the Victorians who originally were translating those, and B, they're downright X-rated.
Yeah.
A lot of the Arabian Night tales. And there's this movie just called The Arabian Nights. It's not Disney, it's Pasolini.
Yeah.
And this, we're talking, you know, it should be called The Full Frontal Arabian Nights.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's on Netflix, by the way, if anybody wants to check it out.
I don't know if you're aware of it. I think it was just recently announced, but Philip Pullman's new book is a retelling of Grimm's fairy tales. And Philip Pullman being the author of The Golden Compass, you know, another popular young adult series that unfortunately didn't translate very well to the screen.
Now, you see? Okay, but go on. Yeah. You see, I liked that movie.
I liked
My problem is I thought that movie ran an hour short.
Yeah. No, you just lost so much of the nuances of the characters and the plot and the actual visualization. And this is my rant. The actual visualization of the world and the, you know, the special effects and all of that was really faithful and really well done.
Chris and Paul just, White's did
you know,
that,
yeah. it was very, you know, it's a common problem with young adult or with film book to film adaptations.
Where and you know that original script was written by Tom Stoppard.
Yes,
and ran another like 90 minutes.
Well, there's a play. There's a play.
Yeah, it was done at the National Theater.
Which I would have loved to see.
Yeah, you know?
I wish
it was filmed.
Yeah, I wish that they had done the
starring
Southern
Timothy Dalton.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I want to see that.
I would have loved to see The Subtle Knife because that's my favorite of the trilogy.
Yeah. And for those who are unaware, the what's the name of it? Is it
His Dark Materials?
His Dark Materials.
And the first book in the UK is called Northern Lights, and here it's called The Golden Compass.
Yeah. Now, you want to talk about brilliant YA material that any adult can appreciate and read. This is not – there's no upper limit on that.
No.
And The Golden Compass was written as, quote, middle grade to start with. So,
that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
It might be in the UK, they might have called it 10 and up. But
yeah. See that because actually they're pretty young protagonists to start with. And, you know, obviously it gets very dark as the series progresses. But
it's extremely dark. Yeah. And it becomes a retelling of Milton of Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
Are variant thereon, and it challenges views of religion, serious views of religion.
Yeah.
So that, you know, this is not your Sunday school book, unless you belong to a really unique Sunday school. So Tom, I'm sorry I interrupted you because you're talking about Pullman's new book, and that just set off a spark for
right.
me. Pullman's new book is a
well. It's a retelling of Grimm's fairy tales, and I'm not sure what his approach is going to be. But there's been kind of a resurgence in fairy tale. I don't think
it's kind of a resurgence.
Well, I mean, it's
there's
always
currently
been there,
two TV yeah. series.
Yeah.
There's Once Upon a Time. There's Grimm.
Right.
Mirror Mirror just opened.
Right.
The thing with Kristen Stewart, the Snow White and the
right.
Huntsman.
Oh yeah, which
is one of three Snow White movies coming out in a 1 year period.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
you know, and there was a Red Riding Hood movie.
Yeah, and actually, even in YA, Cinder. Is a new young adult book by Marissa Meyer, and it's
Cyborg Cinderella.
Yeah,
really. Okay, yeah. And then there was Ash by Melinda Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
Was a very good, I think, young adult lesbian take.
Yeah.
On
Aschpuddel or Cinderella, the German right. in me says Aschpuddel, which I believe predates the Perrault Cinderella, but I'm not quite sure, but.
I'm not up to snuff on my fairy tale history,
no.
unfortunately.
Oh, I am. I love the history of fairy tales. I'm very big on it. And what I think may be exciting or maybe the worst news ever, Rob Marshall, his next movie, in between Pirates of the Caribbean films, because he's doing 4, 5, and 6. He's doing
six. Huh?
Four wasn't horrible.
Four I enjoyed. Actually.
Yeah. So and that was yeah. Rob Marshall.
But I, you
Rob
know.
Marshall also did Chicago and is a great Broadway yeah. director. His next movie is Into the Woods.
Oh.
Sondheim.
Wow.
Okay. And that is the core of what fairy tales are all about. I have a special relationship to that story and to that movie. So, excuse me, to that play.
Mm-hmm.
I saw both productions. Loved the first, did not like the second. Same director, James Lapine. I'm not sure why, but we'll see what Rob Marshall can do with it. We have a few minutes left. Telephone number at WBAI is 212-209-2900. My guests are E.C. Myers, if you're buying the book, or Eugene, if you're talking to the person, and Eddie Schneider. He's an agent. He's Eddie in either event. Good morning. You're on the radio. I waited too darn long. There was the call, and it flitted away. And I suspect some of the other lines are not working. What happens is often people call, and the lights don't necessarily work. But they're back. Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? See, I told you I got phone calls from Bulgaria. How are you, Bobson?
Good morning, Jim Friend. Well, I'm fine. I'm enjoying the show.
Good.
Sorry to hear you're still sick. Is this the last?
This is like...
cold or...
No, this is the same cold I've had for 3 weeks now.
Well, get well soon, I guess.
Really? But it's about bleeding time.
Yeah. Anyhow, I was wondering which would be your preferred translation of the Arabian Tales?
Ooh, that's not a question for me.
That's a
question for another member of Altered Fluids, Richard Bowes.
Hmm. Well, let's call him.
I enjoyed the John Payne version in English that I came across in a library once a few years ago.
How many languages do you read in?
Me?
Yeah.
Three or four. German, English, and Russian, and Bulgarian.
Nice.
Not Arabic yet. So I try not to go for translations because I've seen some things that are not enjoyable. So I limit my translations. But in terms of the Arabian tales, it's one of the exceptions.
Yes, especially with the Arabian tales of the Arabian Nights. It can be so difficult because you're not only dealing with the subtleties of the language, you're also dealing with the mores of the translator.
Yep. Anyway, well, thank you for a good show, and I enjoyed the reading.
Thank you.
I may try the book someday, not really sure if I'll be able to find it anytime soon.
Well, hopefully we'll sell foreign rights in Bulgaria.
Yeah.
Get on
Eddie. We do have a sub-agent in Bulgaria, so perhaps.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
For a good show, and have a good morning.
You too.
You too.
Take care. Yeah, it's mid-morning where he is.
He's having an easier time of it.
Yeah. And that's always that back talk from, not always from Skype, you can always hear. Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing thing, isn't that? I am so pleased and proud of the fact that I get phone calls from Bulgaria and whatever. And maybe there'll be Tom Crosshill calling up next from Latvia. Who knows? And we can do a whole international show. We ought to do that. Good morning. You're on the air. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Hi there. You're on the air.
Hello, yes.
Yeah, turn down your radio. The 7-second delay, or however long our delay is, gets confusing.
So, I just had an experience where I just picked up a book in one of these odd lot stores. I don't often do that, but sometimes. You know, a remaindered book for $1, and you never know what you're going to find. This is a book in a sort of a cult area. Cult, not occult. And
important distinction.
It's either a cult or a cult that is...
I've had a cult for 3 weeks now.
Oh.
Well, there's a statement here, a couple of statements in this in the afterword, so that I found fascinating because I wasn't aware of it. But it sort of puts forward a thesis implicitly that science fiction as we know it, you know, the science fiction that I grew up with in the 50s, came out of pulp fiction. Would you agree with that? It mentions authors like Heinlein, Asimov, A.E. Van Vogt, and Ray Bradbury.
I would say absolutely. I would say that the birth of science fiction, modern science fiction, starts with Mary Shelley and and continues with, you know, Jules Verne and a number of French writers, the romance, the scientific romance tales, as Chip Delaney would put it. Then you have the Victorians and H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells, yeah.
But it was clearly in the pulp magazines that Hugo Gernsback and later John W. Campbell brought science fiction into American popular culture.
That's who they cite, John W. Campbell Jr.'s astounding science fiction.
Yeah.
And the cult that they're promoting here is L. Ron Hubbard.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
But without once mentioning Scientology.
Right.
Just L. Ron Hubbard as the prolific writer.
Yes, he was an amazing... I mean, the man could turn out thousands of words of what I would call tripe. But really great tripe. I mean, they're page-turners. I mean, this is better stuff than a lot of stuff that's being sold today. And I'm not even pre-Battlefield Earth, Slaves of Sleep, Typewriter in the Sky, Fear, the
Bible Blackout.
Yeah. John, you know, he worked for John W. Campbell, who used a lot of writers using pseudonyms. And if he just needed, you know, 10,000, you know, well, not 10,000, but 4,000 words for a given issue, he could call up Hubbard and use Hubbard under one of his many pseudonyms, René Lafayette, or whatever, and Hubbard could just churn it out. And, of course, Scientology was started in the so-called science pages of Astounding Magazine.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. And any number of writers for Astounding, including A.E. Van Vogt and Algis Budrys, were priests of Scientology.
Now, is it true that Heinlein was actually a protege of Hubbard's?
No. Not at all. They hated each other the common myth, and I'm not sure of how true it is, but there are different biographies of each person, is that they were at Annapolis together in War College, basically. And there is a myth that Campbell gave each of them an assignment saying, make up a fake religion. And Heinlein wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, and Hubbard wrote Dianetics. But how apocryphal that is, I don't know. The two gents, however, by all accounts, did not get along. They are contemporaries, and one is not the protege of the other.
Okay.
They both worked for John Campbell, though.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Great show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Oh, my God.
Have a good morning.
And there is, by the way, a hot story. And when I say a hot story, you know, in this week's news about a science fiction writer, Carl Frederick, who just withdrew from the Writers of the Future contest, which has
heard about that.
You know, which is run by...
Which is an arm. It's run by the same people who fund and are a part of Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
But they claim not to be. And I've had dealings with these people. And no, you can attend their events and have nothing to do with Scientology. And I've met wonderful writers and no good people. Andrea Kail, who's a New York writer, was winner of the Writers of the Future and all that. And she went and attended. And there's
Tom Crossell.
Yep, next week.
I didn't know Tom Crossell was a Writers of the Future person. They do good work.
Yeah.
Now, Orson Scott Card is a brilliant writer. Orson Scott Card is also a devout Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
Where does, you know, that we have so many shows about where do certain religions begin and the writing end? William Shun, Bill Shun has been on these airwaves to talk about his life as a Mormon and all that. But what we have to call people out for is a reading, because we're actually over time. My theme began. It's there in the background here. You see, so it's already running. this coming Tuesday, meet these folk in person.
Yes.
E.C. Myers, author of Fair Coin, out from Pyre Books, depending on whether you're reading it or saying it. And Eddie Schneider, who is representing the book, and Alia Dawn Johnson, who's one of my favorite writers, will be the other reader. I'm so glad that we're able to pair. It's a good pairing, you know?
Yeah, and I realized today, actually, we're both Columbia University alums. So
that's right. Yeah, in fact, I met each of you at a New York Review of Science Fiction reading when, I think Terry Bisson was still... No, he was never involved with
Maybe
us.
Maybe Joe?
Yes, Joe Monty. There was about a 4 or 5 month period in which we were all going up to Ferris Booth Hall.
Yeah. Well,
the building that used to be Ferris Booth Hall, which I still have the keys.
Ah, yes.
Because that's where the WBAI Craft Fair was held. But that's another story. The point is, everybody listening, and I expect everybody listening... to show up this Tuesday at 6:30 for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. I almost said the New York Review of Books. I should, 138 Sullivan Street, 6:30 this Tuesday, April 3rd, for E.C. Myers and Alia Dawn Johnson. And Eddie will be there to greet people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be sniffling at the door. So... I hope you can all make it, and I'll see you next week, possibly, with Tom Crosshill.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Eddie. Thanks, Eugene. Everybody, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. Take care.
Red, white, and blue, and spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Call me, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm busy attacking the flag, a rag in a snake.
snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
'99 single list alive right here at Burn Baby Burn, where we burn the American imperialist flag to ashes before 5 o'clock. When Free Speech Radio News comes in, we say OWS overthrow Wall Street, yo. '99 single, they never know. Yes, Robert Knight, this is for you, y'all.